From New York City, welcome to Mark to Markets. I'm your host, Mark Pemsener. On this podcast, we discuss topics near and far from personal finance. Any questions or comments, I can be reached at mark.pemsener@bernstein.com or call me directly at 212-969-6655. Some of the episodes are wide-ranging macroeconomics and all about the markets. This episode will be a bit more of a niche topic, but it's a very important topic for those that it impacts. Planning for friends and relatives with special needs is a complex issue. We're going to delve into that topic on this episode. And the goal is not for this to be a master's class on the subject, but a one-on-one overview on the issues, the key considerations, the things you should be thinking about, and the things you should be asking us and your other professional advisors. To learn more, I've invited Ashley Vettitigi to join. Ashley is the National Director of Planning Research here at Bernstein. Ashley, thanks for joining.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So I know this topic can go in a lot of different directions, everything from government programs to ABLE accounts and trusts. I think I want to start with the notion of special needs trust, if that works for you.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great place to start.
And I think maybe the first thing to demystify is, what is a special needs trust?
Great question. A special needs trust tends to be the primary vehicle that will serve to provide a person with disabilities with the financial support they need to live out their life in the most happy, healthy, independent way possible. Given that typically when we're talking about folks with disabilities or special needs, they meet that qualification because they aren't otherwise able to participate in what's known as substantial gainful activity. Simple enough to say, they aren't working enough to be able to bring in income to provide for their own financial need. And so they are relying on, oftentimes, the assets of others to provide them with that ongoing financial support. What makes a special needs trust special, if you will, is that it is a vehicle that is very specifically drafted and established to ensure that the disabled beneficiary remains eligible for certain government programs that provide them additional financial support. So there's a number of different public benefits programs that provide monthly stipends to somebody who otherwise isn't able to earn a living wage. And many of those programs are means tested, which means to qualify, you have to have very limited income or resources in order to access those benefits. The problem is the benefits on their own aren't enough to provide that individual everything they'll need throughout their lifetime from a financial perspective. So if we have to have assets, we also then need to have them protected so that they don't end up being disqualified from these government programs. And the special needs trusts are the primary vehicle for doing just that.
This may be a technical question, but I don't intend it to be. It's more of the spirit of it. Is there a distinction in the document or in the law between a conventional trust and a special needs trust?
Yeah, very typically within a special needs trust document, there's very intentional language that says sort of two things. One, the way that money comes out of a special needs trust typically should never go directly into the hands of the person with disabilities. And the reason for that is once the money goes into their hands, it's either considered income or an asset of that person, and therefore they end up being disqualified for benefits. So the way that money can be spent out of this trust has to happen in a very particular way. The trustee needs to issue payments from the trust directly to the providers or goods of goods and services, or it's needing to go to a third party as reimbursement for something that that third party paid for on behalf of the person with disabilities. Secondly, there is very typically language in the trust document that acknowledges the need to be aware of implications of the trust assets and the way that those trust assets are utilized from a government benefits perspective. So it will instruct the trustee that they need to be mindful as to how those assets are used and the implications that that could have on government benefits programs.
Now, you've thrown out the word trustee a number of times here. For most people on this call, they're going to be familiar with the notion of a trustee. Is the trustee role particularly more relevant in a special needs trust? Are there ways that you should think about it differently or maybe the same as any other trust?
Yeah, I think in a special needs trust case, it is a little bit more specialized, if you will. Special needs trusts, because they have implications and interactions with government benefits programs, are subject to a lot more detailed and nuanced accountings of how the assets are being utilized. There are trust filings that need to be accomplished. There are the nuances of the specific needs that the person with disabilities has. And so there needs to be added due care and attention to thinking through what can the trust distribute for and what's appropriate relative to the needs of the beneficiary. And because this asset very frequently, or this trust and the assets within it are the only assets that that person will have access to, the trustee really needs to take due care to ensure that spending out of the trust is not just sort of focused on what does this mean for the beneficiary today, but are we spending from this trust in a way that is going to provide them lifelong access to the resources that they will need over time?
You bring up the notion of lifelong. So this is going to be this trust is going to be around for a long period of time. If a parent or grandparent is setting up for someone who's materially younger than them, and might be younger than anyone who they think to be a trustee, it in my mind opens up the idea that there could be a use or a use case for a corporate trustee. Are corporate trustees ever used in this case? Are they more or less popular? How would one think about that?
It's a great question, and I think a corporate trustee can be a really good choice in these instances. I will say many times families will default to presuming or assuming that a neurotypical sibling will serve as the trustee of the special needs trust, or if not a sibling, a cousin or some other family member of the same generation of the disabled person. And the reason that that's a very common choice is one, if you're picking somebody from that same generation, presumably they're also going to be as long-lived as the disabled person themselves. And so you can get a nice long trajectory of utilizing that trustee. And they want the trustee to have deep knowledge and a very close, specific relationship with the person with disabilities, right? This is their loved one. They are having to contemplate, if I, as the primary caregiver, guardian, or parent of this child, am not here to ensure that they are well taken care of, who better than for somebody else in our family who deeply understands this person and our family values and our goals and objectives for this child's, ongoing prosperity and success and independence than a direct member from the family. The downside to choosing a family member as trustee, sort of, it falls into two camps. On the one hand, it is a more administratively burdensome task than serving as trustee on what we view as sort of a more traditional use case of an irrevocable trust for family, because generally because of the accountings that need to happen for public benefits purposes, and sometimes the courts are involved, and so there really is sort of this down in the weeds, nitty-gritty accounting that needs to be done of these trusts. And so maybe just from an administrative burden perspective, it doesn't make sense to utilize a family member. The other is sort of on the softer side of things, which is to say, if you have a beneficiary who is kind of plugged into the fact that these assets are there and they're meant to provide them for their meant to provide for their financial needs, and the beneficiary is then put in a position of coming to the family member to say, "Hey, can I get a distribution because I want to go on this trip or I want to buy this extravagant item?" You are now putting a sibling or another family member in the role of being a gatekeeper to the assets. And as you might imagine, in some instances, that can create some tension between the
Sure.
disabled person and the family. And so it can be for some families a better choice to sort of segregate those roles, let family be family, and have somebody who's in more of a third party administrative operational role to make those yes, no decisions on the specific finances.
You know, you bring up the point of having someone of the same generation. I'll come up with the example of two siblings, one of who is abled and one of who's disabled. And in the unfortunate case that the disabled would have a shorter life expectancy or is just much older, right? So there's a difference in life expectancy. Can the special needs trust pass out to a sibling or someone else in the family when the person of need has passed?
Yes, with a caveat. So we've sort of been speaking about special needs trusts at a very high level. Addressing this question creates the opportunity to provide the distinction that there's actually two primary types of special needs trusts. One is known as the third party trust. This is a trust that's funded by anyone other than the disabled beneficiary themselves. So think parents or grandparents or other family members who are funding this trust for the benefit of the disabled child. That trust in particular, upon the passing of the disabled person, can have the assets flow directly to other family members or any other beneficiaries that are intended and desired. The other type of special needs trust is what's known as a first party special needs trust. This is a trust that is funded with assets that once belonged to the disabled person. This could have occurred because the disability happened later in life after they've already accrued assets. It could have occurred because there was like a medical malpractice issue that resulted in some kind of a settlement that provided with the beneficiary with assets of their own. Or it could have been the result of sort of a misstep in planning where generations ahead, when they passed away, unintentionally left assets directly into the name of the beneficiary. In all of those instances, very frequently, it then requires someone to sort of intervene and push those assets back into a trust for the benefit of that special needs or disabled person. And that trust is known as this first party trust, also sometimes referred to as a self-settled trust or a D4A. They go by a lot of different names, which can add a little bit of confusion to the mix. But this first party trust carries with it a little bit of a special requirement upon the passing of the disabled beneficiary. And that is any assets that are left before they can go on to siblings or other family members or beneficiaries have to first be made available to the state to reimburse the state for any Medicaid expenses that they provided on behalf of the disabled beneficiary. So if the beneficiary was receiving Medicaid insurance benefits from the state gets reimbursed first, and then remaining assets can then flow down to the other beneficiaries who are next in line.
So your comments are really leading me down the path of talking about government assistance programs. But before I do that, I think the last question specific to special needs is, or special needs trust is, are there any rules of thumb for how someone should think about how much to fund it with? I'm sure the answer is going to be, it depends. And maybe that is the only answer, but are there any other guidelines or rules of thumbs?
Yeah, this is the hardest question for a multitude of reasons. One, oftentimes the life expectancy of the disabled person is unknown, or there's greater ambiguity around it than there is for an able-bodied or neurotypical individual. Two, sometimes we don't even know when the trust is going to be funded. It's not uncommon that these trusts are funded upon the passing of the parent or the primary caregiver. And so then we don't know if the trust has to provide 10 years of support or 50 years of support. And three, oftentimes within these cases of disability, there can be sort of changing circumstances. The conditions could be degenerative, which may mean they are very they're not very medically needy today, but that could change and evolve over time. And so it does create sort of this complex calculus that needs to be taken into account when thinking about sizing. The one other point that I will make on this is that it does warrant families sort of taking a bit of a pause to think about the way that they're funding these trusts, it's not uncommon that the initial estate plan for families with multiple children will start from the perspective of everyone is going to get an equivalent distribution. So if there's three kids, any remaining assets in our estate are going to be split a third, a third, a third. And there's some question, particularly when there's a person in the family who has some degree of disability, if fair is equal and if equal is fair. There are certainly circumstances where the person with disabilities needs a greater share of that wealth because they don't have the ability to provide for themselves financially, where perhaps the other two neurotypical children are able to be more self-sufficient from an income and a wealth generating perspective. So that might argue that the special needs trust is funded with more than simply a pro rata distribution of the wealth. There's other instances where maybe that's not the case, where because of life expectancy associated with the condition or sort of other circumstances that dictate maybe there should be less of a funding in that account, because we also know that once the funds are in that account, it's very typical that they can't otherwise be accessed by other family members until after the passing of that individual. So depending on who else this wealth is to benefit, you know, you could really sort of tip the scales in one way versus the other. The point that I would make is that it should be an intentional decision that's made, as opposed to a, well, this is typically what's done in normal estates, and so therefore let's just go with that and hope it works out.
Right. Now we've skirted around the issue of assistance programs for people with disabilities. How does that work hand in hand with a special needs trust, and maybe even more broadly, Ashley, can you maybe just do a quick 101 on on how Social Security and or Medicaid or Medicare benefits work in this space?
Yeah, this can actually be a little bit confusing because there are sort of three primary public benefit financial assistance programs that people with disabilities can qualify for. They are all provided for by the Social Security Administration. And it's not uncommon that people who are receiving these benefits don't even know which one of them they're actually receiving. So the first benefit program that I will start out with is I think the one that most people know about. It's SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance. We are actually not going to focus on that for this conversation. The SSDI is a benefit that somebody who incurred a disability later in life, after they had already been working, after they had already been paying into the Social Security system, and earned a significant number of credits, such that when the disability occurs, they basically are able to trigger benefits sooner by drawing on their own worker benefit. We're going to sort of set that one off to the side because that's not the primary instance in which we are talking about benefits. We're typically talking about benefits sort of in the purpose of this context for somebody who was experienced disability very early on in life or from birth, and thus they were never able to work or engage in substantial gainful activity and didn't earn their own workers' credits towards their own Social Security benefit. In that instance, the primary program that most people become eligible for first is a program known as SSI, Supplemental Security Income. This is a benefit that is intended very specifically to provide monthly financial support to somebody who can't otherwise work and earn a meaningful income, with financial resources to provide for their food and their shelter. It is a very nominal benefit, very nominal benefit. It varies by states. So we're talking about something from the neighborhood of $950 a month up to maybe $1,200 or $1,300 a month. So while it's an important, helpful benefit, I think most of us can agree that $1,000 a month on its own is very likely not enough money for somebody to live in a healthy, safe, fulfilling environment when you account for rent and food and clothing and activities and, you know, entertainment and healthcare and all of those different things. So That's why people who are on that benefit typically also need access to other assets, enter in the special needs trust. And we use that because in order to qualify for this SSI benefit, not only do you have to qualify as being disabled, which according to the Social Security Administration is defined as a person who can't engage in substantial gainful activity, but they also have to be very low income, which they would be if they met that first definition, and have very limited assets. And when I say limited, Mark, this will probably make your head explode to some extent. We're talking about less than $2,000 in their own name.
So nothing.
And it's mind-boggling to contemplate if this person had $3,000, that the way that this program is set up would look at that and say, well, you got a lot of money, so you don't need $900 a month in additional support, because you're
that speaks to the importance of that special needs trust, right? Because just showing $3,000 would ruin this all these programs.
That's exactly right. So we need another pool of capital that can provide them the supplemental support to their SSI, because the SSI on its own is not going to be enough. The question then that I get is, given the limited nature of this SSI benefit, why do we care? Why do we go through sort of these extra steps to put funds in this special needs trust if I'm only otherwise opening up the door to $900 to $1,000 a month in benefit? And the reason is twofold. One, it's access to Medicaid. So qualifying for at least $1 of SSI automatically allows somebody to be eligible for Medicaid. And if they're not working, they don't otherwise have their own insurance, having Medicaid can be a really important component to people's financial pictures, particularly if they're medically needy. And two, SSI oftentimes is a gatekeeper to other opportunities or services that a disabled person might want to take advantage of. The most typical case that I come across is in housing arrangements. So it might be that a person with disabilities isn't able to live independently, but they could thrive in a group home environment. As you might imagine, the need for these kinds of housing programs is somewhat limited. And in order to ensure that the space in these places are being reserved for people who really need it, they oftentimes use a threshold of, you can't join our group home unless you're qualified for SSI. And so even though the financial benefit from SSI may be limited, it may open up the door to other really important opportunities for this person and their family. So maintaining that eligibility could be critical.
Let me ask one last question, because we've gone about 25 minutes. The notion of ABLE accounts, I think some people who are listening to this podcast may be familiar with them, not really know how they fit in. So speak for a bit about what an ABLE account is and how it fits into this picture.
Yeah, ABLE accounts, they're actually relatively new. They've only come about in the last sort of 6 or 7 years. And it was very exciting legislation for the families that this impacts. It's a program that essentially allows a disabled person to set money aside in a special account where the assets can be invested. They get to grow completely tax-free, provided that when the assets are withdrawn from the account, they are used for what's known as qualified disability expenses. The thing that's great about that broad qualified disability expenses requirement is that it is exactly that. It is incredibly broad. So housing, food, clothing, medical, healthcare, like pretty much anything a person with disabilities needs to live and thrive is considered
to broad-based support, right? Yes. Clothing, food, right? It's just to live.
Yep, that's right. And based on the way that this legislation was drafted, any assets held within this ABLE account do not count against that $2,000 resource test for SSI. So this money can be in this account provide them with additional financial support without generally disrupting their government benefits.
That's super helpful. So now you have two paths, right? The special needs trust and the ABLE account. I guess my last question would be, then why the special needs trust if you have the ABLE account?
Yeah, great question. Unfortunately, while these accounts are great, they are somewhat limited. The accounts are never going to grow to be that large, primarily because you are limited to contributing $18,000 per year into these accounts from all aggregate sources. So you can't
put
any more than $18,000 into these accounts. In addition, once the account exceeds a certain asset threshold size, you could end up suspending some of your SSI payments. And in many states, these accounts are also subject to that Medicaid clawback that we talked about with those first party special needs trusts, where before the remaining assets can go on to other family members, the state gets sort of first claim to it. So we typically don't, these are not these should not supplant special needs trusts. They are a great supplement to special needs trusts. They can provide some greater access to direct funds to a person with disabilities, can provide for some greater independence. They've got some tax advantage associated with them.
They have some flexibility, but it's not the thing that's going to support them for decades by any means.
That's it.
Got it. Ashley, this was super helpful. I'm so appreciative of your time. Thank you for joining.
Absolutely, Mark. Thanks for having me.
To our listeners, feel free to email me at mark.penziner@bernstein.com or call me at 212-969-6655 for any questions or comments on this podcast or any other related topic or on any of the recent episodes that you may have heard. And make sure to like us or review this podcast wherever you listen to it. Until next time.